So we're in Daniel, and last week we finished chapter 7. That was Daniel's dream of the four beasts, and we spent a lot of time correlating Daniel's vision with Revelation. I hope showing to your satisfaction that the two do correlate. I'm not sure how long Daniel 8's going to take, but I'm not going to go into 9 tonight, so whatever it is, it is. It's a straightforward vision. And the problem with it is, it's got some symbols in there that look like they're in Revelation. But the events are the events of the end of Babylon to the Maccabean rebellion in Israel. So I'm not sure how well they correlate, so we'll try and sort that out. So starting in chapter 8. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. And I saw in the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa the capital, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision, and I was in the Ulai Canal. So he's having a vision. The vision is 2 years or 3 years, depending, because the first vision was in the first year of Belshazzar. This is in the third year. And depending on where what is, it's either 2 or 3 years. So at this point, Belshazzar is still the king of Babylon. Babylon has not been overturned. And it is at the end of Belshazzar's reign. So Belshazzar is going to be overturned this year. So when Daniel has his vision, in his vision, he is in Susa, which is on the mountains to the east of Babylon. And it's the Persian summer capital kind of thing. It's also called Shushan. So he isn't, at this point, an official in Persian government. So he's having this vision from the perspective of Persia. He is, I would imagine, semi-retired. So he's got this vision. And in the vision, he is transported to Susa. Verse 3, I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him. And there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. And as we'll find out when the interpretation comes from the angel. This is, of course, the Medes and the Persians. This was the bear that was laying on its side and had three ribs in its mouth and so forth. So the Medes and the Persians are going to be able to sweep everything before them all the way over to Greece. That's going to be important because the next one, verse 5, I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a conspicuous horn between its eyes. And he came to the ram with its two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him, and struck the ram and broke his two horns, and the ram had no power to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. And there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. Then the goat became exceedingly great, but when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and instead of it came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Obviously, we know that's Alexander the Great in Greece. You remember in the vision that Daniel had in the last chapter of the terrible beast, the fourth beast, that stomped everything into the ground. You might be tempted to think that this goat stomping everything into the ground is the same thing. It is not. What the goat is obviously Greece. And in order to understand the emotion here that's being expressed in this dream, you have to understand what's going on between the Greeks and the Persians. The Persians headed west, and when they hit Greece, they invaded them twice. The first invasion, they were repulsed at Marathon. They came in and pulled up to the shore in Greece at Marathon, and the Greeks beat them back, and they withdrew. So the second time, under King Xerxes, they came back a second time, and that's when you have the Battle of Thermopylae. And the second time through, they burned Athens, won the Battle of Thermopylae. That's the one where the 300 stand in the valley and a local shepherd guides them around the pass so they can get behind the Greeks in Thermopylae. And they prevail there, they burn Athens, and they start taking the place. They hit Corinth, which is on the isthmus between Macedonia and the Peloponnesian Peninsula. And at that point, they are repulsed and driven back. The whole point here is there is intense personal animosity between the Greeks and the Persians. They really don't like each other. Mostly the Greeks don't like the Persians because of what happened. So when Alexander raises his army and starts going east, when he hits the Medes and the Persians, he is savage with them. And that's what this business of the ram had no power to stand before the goat, because Alexander was perhaps one of the most brilliant military tacticians and strategists in the history of humanity. And he came across without touching the ground, which is to say the Greeks moved so fast that people couldn't react to them. So when they hit the Persians, as I say, the destruction there had a personal cast to it, as opposed to simply being, you're the next one up, we're going to conquer you, and we're going to put you under tribute, and we're going to move on. No personal animosity about it. We're just going to conquer you and expand our empire. This was personal. And that's what that's talking about. Whereas in Revelation and in Daniel 7, where you have the terrible beast who stomps everything into the ground, the thing that I believe is we're talking there about a bureaucratic government that kills its own people, which is what I talked about on Shabbat and I talked about last Tuesday. Speaking of which, I was talking to my son Matthew about this on Sunday when he was up at our house, and he mentioned something that I neglected to mention, that the fourth beast has at the bottom of it its feet and toes iron mixed with clay. And I didn't explain that, and I should have, and I will now. What that means is you have a mixed multicultural society. The iron in the toes is whatever the original people were that assembled the empire. So in the case of Rome, it would be the Romans. They were the iron. They brought in to that empire people from all over the empire, and the people in Rome and in the Roman Peninsula became multicultural. And so you had the iron, which was the original Romans, and then you had everybody else who had no particular loyalty or anything else to Rome. So they finally disintegrated, which, by the way, is what's in the process of happening to us with uncontrolled immigration right now. You have the original stock that built the United States, and now it's being diluted, and the people coming in don't have any particular loyalty to the United States as a principle. It's just a place where you can come and you can get benefits, and you don't have Cossacks running up and down against you and all sorts of things. Lots of good reasons to be here, even if you don't want to be an American. So this late stage empire where you get a mixture of iron and clay, that's what's being talked about there. All right, back to Daniel 8. So you have Alexander the Great, which is the single horn on the goat. So you have a unicorn goat, and that horn gets broken, which is Alexander dies almost to India. He catches something and dies. He doesn't leave an heir. He's a young man. I believe this is off the top of my head, but he was in his 30s when he died. And he basically died of excess, which is to say wine and sex. So whatever combination that was, that's what killed him. He didn't leave an heir, nor did he leave any instructions about what was to happen to this empire that he had assembled. So he has four generals, and the four of them divide up the empire among themselves. So we have four kings that come up. From Daniel's perspective and from our perspective, we're only interested in two of them, and that's Seleucus and Ptolemy. Seleucus has Syria and points east all the way to India. Ptolemy has Egypt. So, of course, the boundary between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies is Israel. When we get to chapter 10, I believe it is, it's a chapter I call the soap opera, you'll have this king of the north and king of the south, and they'll be trading wives, and they'll be invading each other and up and down and back and forth. And quite frankly, unless you have a spreadsheet, you can't figure out what's going on. I did, in fact, make a spreadsheet when I taught this last time. I may resurrect it, or I may just skip it. It is kind of meaningless other than historically. Right, we're up to Daniel 8, 9 now. So out of one of them being the four horns that have arisen after the first horn was broken. So out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. The glorious land is obviously Israel. So he's going to the south, to the east, and the glorious land, which is to say, this is a Seleucid. And they traded invasions, they routinely invaded each other and all that kind of thing. This little horn is Antiochus IV, who is a Seleucid king. He called himself Antiochus Epiphanes, which is Antiochus the God, if you will, or the God to come, or the one to come, or, you know, very messianic term. And by the way, this little horn business is one of the sources of confusion between Daniel 7 and Daniel 8 and Revelation. Because in Revelation and Daniel 7, you have this little horn that comes up, and it's very clear, at least to me, that that's talking about Revelation stuff. It is not clear at all to me here. But you will read commentaries that will take this little horn and try and fit it into Revelation. Very good Bible scholars, not throwing rocks at any of them. I just don't see it that way. All right, verse 9. Out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south and toward the east and toward the glorious land. It grew great, even to the host of heaven, and some of the host and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host, and the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown. This, by the way, is where I'm going to disagree with the commentary that you gave me. It's a good commentary. But he's a rapture guy, first off, and I'm not. He's saying, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. If we're talking about bringing down the host of heaven, you got to be talking about something in Revelation. Understand the point, don't agree. Let's go to Revelation 12. And a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns on its heads and 7 diadems. No question about who that is, at least not to me. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth, and the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. She gave birth to a male child, one who was to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, in which she is to be nourished for 1,260 days, which is 3.5 years. I am seeing the sun, the moon, and the 12 stars. That, of course, takes you back to Joseph's dream. Joseph has a dream where the sun, the moon, and the 12 stars bow down to him. So the idea that stars can be used of Israel as well as of heavenly beings, I think, is perfectly sound. And given that all the rest of this talks about the time from the fall of Babylon to the end of the Maccabean rebellion, I am suggesting to you that this little horn is not the same as the one we see in Revelation. Reasonable people will vary, and you can read commentaries that'll go the other way. Both of them perfectly respectable positions. Do with that as it seems good to you. I believe that the little horn in Daniel 8 is Antiochus Epiphanes. He is a Seleucid king. He is the last of the Seleucid kings. His father, Antiochus III, invaded Egypt. And when he came back, Rome entered the fray. So Rome did not want the two empires to coalesce. So Rome stood on the shore of Israel and drew a circle around him and says, you're not going to leave this circle until you agree with what we want to do. And so he got pushed back and had to give up any ambitions to be in Egypt. This naturally annoyed him. So when his son, Antiochus IV, goes down and tries to capture Egypt, in that process, he takes all of Israel. And he is trying to consolidate all of his empire with a single religion and a single language. So what he does is he makes the worship of Jehovah and the circumcision of children, any of the trappings of Judaism, illegal on pain of death. One of the things he does is he takes the temple and he erects a statue of Zeus in the temple, and he sacrifices a pig on the altar. He is literally trying to wipe out Judaism. Now, in that process, there are two groups of Jews. There are the traditional Torah observant Jews, and then there are the Hellenized Jews. Hellenized Jews are Jewish Greeks. They are on the side of Antiochus. And the Torah observant Jews, or Torah observant wannabe Jews, are at odds, just like they are today. You know, they can't get along with each other. And the thing that finally happens is Antiochus starts sending his minions throughout the land, and he would go into each city and he would find a prominent man. And he said, all right, if you're loyal to the king, you have got to sacrifice a pig and you have got to eat pork. And at that point, John Hyrcanus said, you and your horse you rode in on, and slaughtered them. That just naturally annoyed the Greeks. But that was the kickoff of the Maccabean Rebellion. Those are the events that are being described here in Daniel 8. So Daniel 8 ends with the restoration of the temple after Antiochus. Hence, I believe that the symbols in here are not Revelation symbols, they are Maccabean symbols. Reasonable people can differ, but that's what I think. Let's pick it up at 9 again. Out of one of these came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. It grew great, even to the host of heaven. And some of the host and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. If my interpretation is correct, where the stars are the 12 tribes of Israel, as in Joseph's dream, as in Revelation 12, then we're talking about him trampling observant Jews. The guys who think it's a Revelation thing, they take that and say, whoa, wait a minute. These events are end-time events when you have Satan motivating the beast. I don't agree, but that's okay. I understand. Verse 11. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host, and the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown. That's the desecration of the temple. And again, the commentary that Ken gave me, he became great even as great as the Prince of the Host. Well, no man is as great as Yeshua, who's the Prince of the Host, right? And that's what he's hanging his hat on. Not an unreasonable position, I just don't agree with it. The point is, he declared himself to be a God king. That's what Antiochus Epiphanes is. I'm a God king. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to desecrate the temple of your God. And I believe that's what's being said there. Verse 12. And a host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offering because of transgression. And it will throw truth to the ground and it will act and prosper. So what happened there is they forbade all practice of Judaism. According to Josephus now, one of the things that would happen is if a mother circumcised her son and was caught, they would kill the son and hang the dead body of the son around her neck and then crucify her. 13. Then I heard a holy one, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, "For how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state." 2,300 does not match 1,260. Another reason I think that we're talking about two different things. 2,300 evening and mornings. Genesis 1, there was evening and there was morning one day. That would be 2,300 days. It could also mean half of that, 2,300 evening and morning sacrifices, where you have two sacrifices each day. So the regular temple service is every day there were two sacrifices, one in the evening and one in the morning. In which case, it's half of that, which is 1150. That happens to be the time between the desecration of the temple and the time the Maccabees consecrated. This is according to the Bible Knowledge Commentary out of Dallas Theological Seminary. So if that's not right, it's because they're wrong. So verse 15. When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. I would think so. And behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and it called, "Gabriel, make this man understand the vision." This is a Chuck Misslerism. You have got somebody who is giving Gabriel orders. Gabriel's an archangel. So his thought is you have either God or Yeshua is talking to Gabriel and saying, "Go give this guy an understanding." Verse 17. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, "Understand, O son of man, that the vision is for the time of the end." Now, this is a marker that people who think we're talking about Revelation will trot out. I think it's at the end of the Maccabean rebellion, not the end of days. And if you think it's the end of days, God bless you. You can read it that way. 18. And when he had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face on the ground. But he touched me and made me stand up. And we've said this lots of times. Signature event when somebody is confronted with an angelic being as he goes down like a sack of rocks. Over and over in Scripture. And the first thing that the angel said when they appeared to the shepherds was, "Fear not." So the idea that he goes down like this is absolutely typical. So Gabriel picks him up and made him stand. And he said, "Behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation, for it refers to the appointed time of the end." Now we have the end of the indignation and then the time of the end. And what I'm suggesting to you is the end of the indignation and the time of the end are the end of the Maccabean rebellion and the end of the desecration of the temple by the Greeks. Verse 20. As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Medea and Persia. And the goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn between his eyes is the first king. As for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. In other words, none of his four generals was able to reconstitute the empire that Alexandria had. None of them, quite frankly, was of a talent of Alexander. It's interesting, most of you know I'm a retired Army guy. And when we were studying war, there's a break at the American Civil War. Before the American Civil War, you had what were called great captains. They were brilliant military tacticians and leaders. After that, you had what became known as great generals. And the difference was logistics. The great generals were not necessarily brilliant tacticians themselves, they were brilliant logisticians, which meant that they could amass great quantities of material where it needed to be, men and material, and would be able to overwhelm their enemy. That's what the United States did in World War II. By the end of World War II, the United States was building a ship a day. We were building aircraft that Germany and Japan just couldn't imagine. In fact, a German soldier came over to the United States after the war and he toured the United States and he said, "We never had a chance. There's no way." As somebody said, a nation, and I'll pick numbers, a nation that only makes 30 million tons of steel a year should not pick a fight with a nation that makes 100 million. And that's the difference between a great captain who has great battlefield presence. Napoleon was a great captain. Lee was a great captain, okay? Grant was the first of the great generals. Wasn't a particularly good tactician. I mean, he was all right, but that wasn't his strong point. What his strong point was getting overwhelming force at a single place at a single time. So Alexander was a great captain. None of his generals attained to that level of talent. He was also a great organizer. He was able to put an empire together. None of his generals was able to do that. Verse 22. "As for the horn that was broken in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. And at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. His power shall be great, but not by his own power. And he shall cause fearful destruction and shall succeed in what he does and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints." The people who are the saints. Remember we had trampling on stars and stuff earlier? Here we're talking about the saints, which are Israel. And notice he is motivated and empowered, if you will, by the dragon. So again, if you are a Revelation buff and you want this to be in Revelation, he's got the power of Satan behind him, which he does. But Satan wasn't limited to just one. 25. "By his cunning, he shall make deceit prosper under his hand, and in his own mind he shall become great." Notice, in his own mind he shall become great. "Without warning, he shall destroy many. And he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken, but by no human hand. He will die a natural death. The vision of the evenings and the mornings that has been told, it is true, but seal up the vision, for it refers to many days from now." A couple of things there. Without warning, he shall destroy many. I owe Rabbi Foreman for this insight. If you read in the first chapter of Exodus, the way the Israelites were enslaved is they sent, and the Hebrew word is sari misa, two words, which means masters of tribute, which means tax collectors. And so they sent tax collectors and they taxed the Israelites into slavery. In the book of Maccabees, you have that same word in Greek. In other words, it is transliterated Hebrew and Greek. In many of your translations, it will say Mysian commanders. What Rabbi Foreman says is no. Whoever was writing Maccabees was echoing Exodus. So what Antiochus did was he sent tax collectors into Israel, and those tax collectors would go on raids without warning in order to raise revenue. So it says here in verse 25, "By his cunning he shall make deceit prosper." In other words, he sends tax collectors. Who expects a tax collector to all of a sudden pull out a sword and come after? Well, maybe nowadays they do it. You have any idea how many weapons the IRS has bought? A lot. In fact, they're making ammunition too expensive because they're buying it all up. Anyway, but by his cunning he shall make deceit prosper under his hand, and in his own mind he shall become great, and without warning he shall destroy many, and he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken. In other words, these tax collectors are going to put Israel under tribute, and they are also going to be going throughout there and doing the business with, hey, you're the chief of the local village here, I want you to come up here and sacrifice a pig and eat some bacon to show everybody that you're loyal. And if you don't do that, you're not loyal, and we'll deal with you accordingly. And of course, John Hyrcanus said no and killed him. But these are not mid-level bureaucrats. These are exactors of tribute. But the whole idea is by cunning, which is to say, I'm just sending in tax collectors here, no big deal. What's happened is they have been enslaved and the temple has been overrun and they are being both taxed into slavery and oppressed if they try and exercise their religion. So that's what's being described here in the book of Daniel. And of course, he shall be broken, he'll die. This is Antiochus. Now, I don't think his death was particularly dramatic. I think he just died of some disease over on the border of India, you know, the eastern part of his own empire. And then the vision of the evenings and the mornings that has been told is true, but seal up the vision, for it refers to many days from now. This book will be sealed up. Both the vision and at the end will be sealed, which I think is why so many people have so much trouble understanding it. I am certainly not sitting here saying that I've got a lock on it, because there's very good Bible scholars that don't agree with me. 27. And I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. Then I rose and went about the king's business, but I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it. I mean, you had an angel come and explain it to you. What do you mean you don't understand it? I find that very humorous into this whole thing. So that's Daniel chapter 8, and my understanding about it is it's a contained prophecy just covering the events from the fall of Babylon to the death of Antiochus Epiphanes. Do with that as seems good to you. Now, later on in Daniel, he'll do some stuff that's deep. And certainly Daniel 7 and the visions there have got a bunch of Revelation stuff in it, so I don't have any problem with that. The other thing, by the way, one of the things that happens in Daniel 8, but is not called that, is the abomination of desolation. And that's where Antiochus puts up a statue of Zeus in the Holy of Holies and sacrifices a pig on the altar. So what he does is he does an abominable thing which makes the temple desolate. Yeshua will refer to this, and he'll say, when you see the abomination of desolation referred to by Daniel the prophet, get out of Jerusalem. Now, what that tells me is that there's two instances of that. You had the one under Antiochus, then you have it again under Rome, then I believe you will have it a third time under the beast. Now, if you're a preterist, you think everything was wrapped up nicely in 70 AD. The temple was desecrated, you know, all of this stuff happened in 70 AD, which it did. But just like there were two abominations of desolation, if you will, I believe there's going to be a third one. Don't have any problem with that at all. But a preterist would say, no, all done. It's up to us to make disciples of the whole world, and when we're done making disciples of the whole world, Yeshua will come back and we'll hand it to him. Okay, I understand what you just said. I don't think that's the way it's going to play out, but I understand. And again, it is a respectable position. We have a couple of preterists in the congregation, and we do lunch, and it's okay. We're not at daggers drawn or anything like that. We just don't see it the same way. Comment was very good. When Daniel has his vision, the temple is in ruins. The temple is not going to get built until Ezra and Nehemiah. which are in the future yet. Now, understand, and we'll read Daniel's prayer in chapter 9 next. Daniel is perfectly aware of Jeremiah's prophecy. Remember, Daniel, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel are contemporaries. They know each other. They correspond. So Daniel knows Jeremiah's prophecy. He knows 70 years are decreed for the exile. So in Daniel 9, what he's going to say is, Daniel realizes that the 70 years is coming to an end. And he then prays for his people. So Daniel fully expects that Israel will be restored to the land. The temple will be rebuilt because he's got Ezekiel's vision. So the idea that it doesn't exist now, I don't think especially bothers him, because I think he knows what the prophecies are, and of course he trusts God. And once it's rebuilt and everybody goes back, then as you say, it'll be desecrated again for pretty much the same reasons.